The headlines. Iran says uranium enrichment continues in the Natanz nuclear facility, despite Sunday's terrorist attack by Israel. The European Union's policing agency warns that the COVID-19 pandemic could fuel organized crime in Europe in the years ahead. And two Ukrainian soldiers are killed in clashes with pro-Russia separatists in Ukraine's war-torn east. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us. Iran has reportedly identified the person who had disrupted the flow of power at the Natanz nuclear facility, causing a blackout there. Iranian media cited an intelligence source as saying that all necessary measures are underway to arrest the person who caused the blackout at the nuclear plant on Sunday. Earlier, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif accused Israel for the incidents, pledging that Tehran will take revenge. Zarif cited by media as saying that Israelis think that this way they can revenge on the success made in recent talks aimed at reviving the Iran nuclear deal. However, he said that they will get their answer in more nuclear advancements. The foreign ministry has also condemned the Israeli sabotage as an act of nuclear terrorism.
What happened in Natanz was a bold act of nuclear terrorism on Iranian soil. There has been no casualty or contamination reported, but it could very much resulted in a catastrophic situation. So it can be considered under the category of crimes against humanity, which the Israeli regime has been doing that for many years now.
Khatibzadeh said that Iran reserves all rights to respond to the attack and has started communications with international authorities in this regard. Khatibzadeh stressed that the incident at Natanz will not slow down Iran's nuclear program, instead speed up the country's nuclear advancement. He said the damaged IR-1 centrifuges will be replaced with more advanced ones. Head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Ali Akbar Salehi, has also said that the incident has not caused any disruption to the enrichment process at Natanz, as emergency power is provided to the facility. The European Union has warned against attempts to derail talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The EU made the warning in reference to the intentional power outage that hit Iran's Natanz nuclear facility on Sunday. The bloc said that it rejects any move that undermines or weakens diplomatic efforts on the nuclear agreement, but it stopped short of calling the incident an attack or an act of sabotage. Iran has blamed Israel for the incident. Meanwhile, Germany's foreign minister said the development is not positive.
What we're hearing from Tehran at the moment is not a positive contribution, especially the recent developments regarding Natanz.
Russia also expressed hope that the incidents at Natanz will not undermine the Vienna talks. Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, or the JCPOA, are scheduled to reconvene for talks on the accord on Tuesday. This follows two rounds of talks, which Iran and the EU have described as constructive. The aim of the negotiations is convincing the U.S. to remove sanctions it imposed on Iran after withdrawing from the JCPOA under the former President Donald Trump. Tehran says the removal of sanctions is a prerequisite to reverse the remedial measures it took in response to the failure of the other JCPOA signatories to honor their commitments. The head of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says the United States is the main source of insecurity and organized terrorism in the region. Ali Shamkhani made the remark in a meeting with Iraq's National Security Advisor Qasem Mohammad Jalal al-Araji in Tehran. Shamkhani noted that accelerating the implementation of the Iraqi parliament's legislation for the expulsion of U.S. troops will improve stability in the Arab country. He said the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis further exposed Washington's support for terrorism. Following the assassination last January, the Iraqi parliament voted for the withdrawal of all foreign forces from the country. The European Union's policing agency says the COVID-19 pandemic could fuel organized crime in the years ahead in Europe. Europol's director warned about the impact of the pandemic on the lives of citizens, the economy, and the rule of law in the continent. Catherine de Boulle said that drug trade in particular is fueling corruption across the EU. According to the agency's four-yearly report, unprecedented quantities of cocaine are trafficked to Europe from Latin America. The report says crime gangs are also adapting to the pandemic with great ease, making profit off the needs and fears of society. The increase in cybercrime and the exploitation of legal businesses for criminal activity are also highlighted in the Europol's assessment. Jerome Hughes is a correspondent who joins us from Brussels to tell us more about this. Well, obviously one of the side effects of COVID here, but I'm also under the impression that when it comes to the flow of drugs, in particular cocaine, if I'm correct to say this, because I read it somewhere, Jerome, is that cocaine has, Europe has become more ideal of a destination for the large drug dealers as opposed to the U.S. because of the fact that it seems like prison terms and are not as severe as it is in the U.S.
That's right, Cave. That's one element to it. Of course, we have open borders here under the Schengen system as well, less so now, I suppose, with the pandemic. But there's no doubt that cocaine is rife right across the European Union. And we've been hearing this actually for years. It's not just cities, it's not just towns, but actually in every village, in every townland, we're often told that it's as easy to buy cocaine as it is to buy a packet of cigarettes. That's how widespread the problem is. And another issue to further underline that, you'll remember back in February, we were reporting that the Dutch and the German authorities, during coordinated searches at EU ports, had found 23 tons of cocaine. So that's a huge amount, obviously. So it just shows you the amount that's coming in. And obviously some of it's detected, but most of it is not detected. And of course, this is a major scourge. I mean, these organized crime gangs, it's not just drugs as well. There's a major problem with cyber security attacks. And now with the pandemic, you also have a situation whereby, you know, they're targeting vulnerable people. So you have vulnerable businesses that are really struggling financially. So they can target them. They can muscle in on those businesses and also vulnerable individuals. And look at the situation with the undocumented. I mean, you have a situation here where you have millions of people in the EU who are undocumented. That means that when they lost their part-time jobs, they didn't get any support from the governments. And so they're very much on the target list as well for these organized crime gangs. And you mentioned drugs, of course, coming from Latin America. We're talking about cocaine. But you'll remember the former EU foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, said on a number of occasions that actually one of the good reasons to improve relations with Iran was to try and stop the scourge of drugs coming from Afghanistan, because we know that Iran stops so much drugs on its borders there with Afghanistan and so on. So, you know, that's one element to it. But also you have to consider that we're hearing as well that the European Commission, in terms of the response, the European Commission is saying that what it will do, this coming Wednesday, in fact, it's going to launch a major five-year strategy in terms of its efforts to combat organized crime. The issue there, of course, is that we've seen similar initiatives in the past, and it just doesn't seem to be working because these organized crime gangs are always one step ahead. And we know also the reports, and we're hearing it from Europol and other authorities, that they're also becoming more vicious. They have more access to guns as well. So it's a problem. It's not just drugs. It's not just cybersecurity. It's also prostitution, people being trafficked. We know that there's major prostitution, even here, for example, in Belgium, where vulnerable people are taken advantage of. And really, there's so much money involved here, you see. That's the problem. We're talking about billions of euro every year. And, you know, and that's just an estimate. So when you have something which has so much money involved, then the incentive for these organized crimes to keep one step ahead is enormous. And we'll just have to wait and see what the European Commission says on Wednesday on all of this.
Indeed. Thank you very much for that, Jerome. We do appreciate it. Jerome Hughes there talking to us from Brussels. Thank you. Moving on, Ukraine says two of its soldiers have been killed in clashes with pro-Russian forces in the country's war-torn east. The Ukrainian army said one serviceman was killed on Saturday and the other on Monday. This comes amid renewed clashes in eastern Ukraine that have left the ceasefire, brokered last year, in tatters. Kyiv accuses Moscow of deploying troops and arms near its borders to support the pro-Russian fighters. It says Russia has some 41,000 troops along Ukraine's eastern border. Russia has denied the allegations, saying its military movements are for self-protection against the NATO buildup. Moscow has also accused Kyiv of taking provocative measures near its borders. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. U.S. police have clashed with protesters who had gathered in the city of Minneapolis to condemn the police killing of yet another African-American man. Police used tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse the crowd. Demonstrators gathered outside of the police headquarters holding Black Lives Matter banners and signs calling for justice. They later blocked the route despite heavy police presence in the area. 20-year-old Dante Wright was killed after officers attempted to take him into custody for traffic violation on Sunday. He tried to get back into his vehicle when the deadly encounter happened. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has launched an investigation into the shooting. Dwight Reed is our correspondent joining us from Washington, D.C. to tell us more about this, and we also have Mike Malcolm, community organizer, who joins us from Tampa, Florida. Dwight Reed, first over to you. Tell us what you can about this, and if you've heard what the word is out on the streets in terms of people, protests, etc.
Well, still fairly early on, lots of details yet to be filled in. What we do know is that yesterday in the afternoon, police apparently, due to what was subsequently explained as an air freshener being displayed in the vehicle, attempted to pull over 20-year-old Dante Wright in Brooklyn Center, a suburb of Minneapolis. What we know from the conversation that he had with his mother immediately before this fatal interaction, apparently he was extremely scared and, according to police, attempted to make some kind of evasive maneuver, and that's when they saw fit, apparently, to gun him down. Really terrible scene. Dante Wright, 20 years old, had a 2-year-old child that a lot of sort of viral posts on social media are highlighting, just the age of the victim here and how much he sort of had going for him. Now his life was just sort of beginning to get started in that sense. A lot of anger in the immediate aftermath, crowds of upwards of 100 people, up to as many as 200 or 300, arrived at the scene of the killing and later went down to the Brooklyn Center Police Department to demand justice. Police responded with tear gas, with rubber bullets, really just sort of blanketing the area with sort of waves of tear gas and smoke grenades. Lots of local residents, including those who live in the apartment buildings opposite the police department, were screaming out, saying, "Children live here, please stop gassing our apartments, our homes." And that really didn't end until sometime around midnight. The the Minnesota National Guard was deployed. We saw some level of property damage, with police saying that somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 businesses were damaged after this extremely aggressive police response. Not a whole lot developing yet today, but we'll definitely have to keep an eye on things as they probably begin to heat up again tonight.
Okay, very well. Life. Malcolm, here we go again with another shooting incident here, and it's just tragic given the fact that this young man was so young. You know, when you take a look at the statistics, unfortunately, it seems like the police violence and killings have increased year in, year out from what I'm looking at over here, and especially alarming that the rate of fatal police shootings among African-Americans was much higher than for any other ethnicity. What are your thoughts when an incident like this particular one has happened now?
Well, Ayanna Monet Stanley Jones was 7 years old when police killed her in 2002. Tamir Rice was just 12 years old when police killed him in 2014. So I'm not, you know, I don't, yeah, you know, our brother Dante was young, but, you know, the police don't care how young an African is or how old an African is. If you're African, they'll kill you in this country. And that's been the historic reality for African people here. Our problem is we have not, when I say we, I mean African people and other oppressed people in this country have not yet learned how to best protect ourselves from these aggressors. You know, Dante made a prudent move. He's supposed to escape the historic killers of African people if he can. Supposed to fight them if he can. Supposed to yeah, make sure that he can get home safe if he can. So this question of his age, this question of he tried to make an invasive move is you know, all speaks to some kind of distraction, if you will, because the reality is African people in the United States are colonized people. The colonizer will always do everything it can to keep the colonized in the web. And it's the colonized people's responsibility to do everything possible to get out of the damn web, to get out of the web. And so Dante, you know, unfortunately didn't have, you know, the organization that he needed to free himself. And I know we're talking about the protesters, the demonstrators, the people that, listen, like Malcolm X once said, you know, we have to be equal. If we're going to be equal, we got to be equal. You know, they got their flag, we need our flag. In this instance, they got their bullets, we need our bullets. And, you know, that's the only way we're going to be able to secure ourselves from the kind of aggression we see all the time, regardless of whether you're 7, 14, 70, or 20, like young Dante, against us by the state.
The reasons as to why this happens are obviously many, but what do you think is the core reason behind the way that the police behave, which involves violence, which involves what has happened, for example, to Dante and many others like him? I mean, is it their training that yields these types of actions that are so violent, and again, that leads to deaths?
No, it's power. It's a power struggle. And right now, African people and other colonized and oppressed people in this country are, you know, on the low end of the power struggle. And because of that, white people, whether you're talking chattel slave owners, who, I mean, you know, this thing about Dante made some evasive moves. There's this white guy named Samuel Adolphus Wright, who was a physician in the 1800s, who said that, you know, Africans had some kind of disease called drapetomania if we tried to run away from the slave master. So, I mean, you know, whether you're talking to slave master or whatever, white people, colonizers who have power, use that power to maintain the power. And it comes in, and the only way they can maintain this power they have is to threaten, kill, and scare African people by the most atrocious and barbaric types of behavior. The reason why it keeps happening, though, is not their fault. They suppose the colonizers are doing what they should do in order to maintain power for themselves. The colonized must get organized and fight. In order to overturn it. So the only reason why it still happened is because the colonizer is more organized than the colonized. But the colonized is coming. And once we get organized well enough to fight back, they're going to have to slow down. They will. It's going to stop. Yeah. I said, when they got their bullets, we got our bullets. You know, it's going to be a different kind of situation. And it's coming.
Okay, thank you. We'll leave it there. Wyatt Reed, our correspondent from Washington, D.C., thank you for the update on life. Malcolm talking there, community organizer from Tampa, Florida. Many thanks. And that does it for our news review. And that does it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. all produced by IRIB English Radio. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. If you happen to visit a carpet market ever in your life, surely you will become excited by seeing a world of design, color, and beauty. Seeing all those beauties and art encourages everyone to choose a beautiful carpet to buy. Iranian carpet is one of the most popular carpets in the world and enjoys a high level of popularity and fame. Today I have come to Kerman, a city in the center of Iran where its carpets have international fame. Carpets and the activity of weaving carpets mainly originate in Asia. Researchers say Iran, Turkestan, and Caucasus are the cradle of the art of carpet weaving. Also in the countries like Turkey, Spain, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Egypt, China, and even in the Balkans, the carpet industry and the art of carpet weaving has been common, and people of these regions are active in this field. According to studies, the first carpet in the world is an Iranian rug called Pazirik. This rug was discovered in 1949 by a team of Russian archaeologists in the excavations in Altai region in southern Siberia, in a valley by the same name of Pazirik. Researchers believe Pazirik dates back to the era of Parthians or the Medes during the Achaemenid Empire. Right now, I am in a carpet weaving workshop. A group of women are weaving a beautiful carpet while their cute kids are busy playing. These ladies recite the number and color of the knots they're weaving vociferously and in a rhythmic tone. So, by this way, their activity gets a type of order and makes them do their job with more carefulness. How soothing is the sound of carpet weaving. The carpet comb is a tool with metal dents which are placed in orderly spaces. The handle of the comb can be wooden or metal. The comb weighs around 0.5 kilograms. After weaving a row, the carpet weaver pushes down on the weft so that the warp and weft are pressed firmly. After weaving several rows, the weaver cuts off the long lengths with big special scissors. The Iranian carpet is the most beautiful handicrafts in the world indeed. I never knew the old red rug which I have inherited from my grandmother and tread on it every day, fancy-free, has so much effort behind it. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Gentlemen, this is John, and I welcome you back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent and overall in the region of South Asia. This episode focuses on two things. First of all, being the change in dynamics of the Chinese-Indian and Pakistani relationship due to a big step being taken by China. And the second one being the brain drain of the Indian economy. Please stay with us and stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about China's digital Silk Road project and its revolutionary promises for communication and connectivity from Asia to Africa and Europe. And we shall take a look at the increasing rate of immigration by Indian millionaires to Western countries and what it means for the Indian society.
China is about to complete another part of its Belt and Road initiative. But this part of the Silk Road is digital. The Pakistan-East Africa Connecting Eurocable, abbreviated as PEACE, is now set for the final stretch. This cross-border fiber optic cable in Pakistan is the latest part of a continental network that is called the Digital Silk Road. It will connect to a submarine cable in the Arabian Sea to service Europe and countries participating in China's Belt and Road initiative, the biggest infrastructure undertaking in the world.
China's ambitious Belt and Road Initiative, or BRI, has a digital side. Dubbed the Digital Silk Road, it is a colossal communication grid stretching from the Chinese mainland all the way eastward to Africa and Europe. The impacts of this digital Silk Road can potentially surpass the vast influence of the connectivity network on the ground or the seas, because the future is digital. China is fast becoming the global leader of cutting-edge technologies, and nothing seems to be able to stop it, not even a global disaster. When the COVID pandemic started to negatively affect some of the BRI projects, such as a $6.8 billion railway project in Pakistan, Beijing moved to speed up the digital aspect of the project, stepping up the development of the communications infrastructure. For all the partner countries along the way, the Digital Silk Road means higher quality in telecommunication with significantly lower costs, as well as more employment opportunities and technology transfer. However, there are some state and private players who are getting more and more frightened of the looming evolutionary leaps in cybersphere.
Forging the Digital Silk Road forward, China is bringing technology and additional benefits to participating countries by establishing training centers and R&D programs to boost cooperation between scientists and engineers in these countries and with their Chinese counterparts. Chinese firms are exporting know-how in areas such as telecommunications networks, artificial intelligence, e-commerce, cloud computing, smart cities, robotics, and clean energy, among others. So, who is against this project? Who doesn't want a better connected Eastern Bloc with China as its binding glue?
Since Beijing launched the Digital Silk Road DSR in 2015, it has increasingly become a substantial part of the overall strategy of the Belt and Road Initiative. Via the project, China provides economic support and technological assistance to recipient states. Observers see this as a strategic move to circumvent international telecommunication consortiums that are dominated by Western and Indian companies. The Hengtong Group, one of China's leading fiber optic and power cable makers, is heading a consortium of telecom companies from Africa, Pakistan, and Hong Kong to install the Pakistan East Africa Connecting Europe, or Peace Cable, in the Indian Ocean and the Mediterranean. The laying of sea cable in Pakistan's territorial waters is scheduled to begin in March, following government approval of CyberNet, a local internet service provider, to construct an Arabian Sea landing station in Karachi. The Mediterranean section of the cable is already being laid from Egypt to France, and the 15,000-kilometer-long cable is expected to go into service later this year.
Okay, so for further insight and analysis, we are joined by Mr. Mike Billington. He's an executive at the Intelligence Review. Mr. Billington, welcome to this show. So, when China makes the digital road operational, it may be the end of the Western hegemony over the cyberspace. What is it that the United States is doing to topple this project?
Well, the most obvious is that under the last administration, under Mike Pompeo and his fanatic friends, they succeeded in breaking Donald Trump's effort to have a good relationship with China. Once they resolved the trade deal, and they were able to implement these vile, illegal attacks on Huawei and TikTok and other technologies coming out of China. So the Pompeo went around the world to basically browbeat countries into breaking from altogether and not using Chinese technology. Under threat of economic sanctions, under threat of isolation. So, you know, we'll see what happens with Biden. Biden, despite being a fanatic about shutting down the industrial infrastructure with his crazy Green New Deal, he has shown some signs that he wants to reestablish decent ties with China. He lifted the ban on TikTok. He lifted the effort to shut down WeChat. He hasn't said anything about Huawei yet, and he hasn't moved to release the daughter of the head of Huawei from this insane and illegal incarceration up in Canada. But these are things he could do, should do. He correctly identified after his two-hour call with Xi Jinping that China's main concern is that every time they have allowed internal disunity, they've been attacked by foreign forces, like the British Opium Wars and related things. So he recognizes that Xi Jinping needs to keep the country united, and he said he would not, Biden said he would not allow things to get back to these warring blocks from the Cold War days. We'll see if he lives up to it. He has to deal with a military-industrial complex, which even Trump was unable to overcome when he wanted to end the endless wars around the world. So it's a very dangerous moment, but we have to give him the benefit of the doubt that he's going to try to move towards cooperation with China, including dropping this crazy attack on Huawei and other IT.
Okay, so China has increased efforts and investments in the Digital Silk Road Project since COVID pandemic and economic problems have slowed down or even stopped China's progress in railroad and highway projects. Do you see a stop to this? And what role do you see of the U.S. administration in this regard?
Oh, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that there's a stopping of the rail and road developments. Obviously, the pandemic and the lockdowns caused some problems. But I think the main reason we saw a slowing down of the infrastructure investments was because of the threatening war with the United States under Pompeo. So we'll see how this proceeds. I don't think there's any, like I said, other than the browbeating from the Pompeo and Christopher Wray types against other nations to not use Chinese technology. Other than that, I don't see anything that would stand in their way. It's well known that they have the best technology and by far the cheaper costs for most of this IT, and most countries are in great demand for this quality of work. It doesn't mean not working with the U.S. side of these things. China has never done what Pompeo's crowd did here and demand that people only work with China and not work with the U.S. and Europe. So I don't expect they will make those kinds of demands. And the only thing that could hold people back would be either real competition in the sense of better quality goods coming from the West, or the kind of, you know, outright attack from the Pompeo types. And we're not clear yet which direction Biden's going to go on this thing. He's made some positive steps. He's also allowed the same line to come out of his cabinet that came out of the Trump cabinet about China is our adversary and their malign activities and their human rights violations and all these lies that were concocted as part of this McCarthyite witch hunt, racist witch hunt against the Chinese. So we'll see how this proceeds. The LaRouche organization is going to fight like hell to break through this anti-China hysteria amongst the population here and around the world. And to make it clear that if we don't get the U.S. and Russia and China working together to deal with the global economic crisis, the global pandemic, and all other global problems, that we're heading for a very, very dangerous situation, including the potential of a nuclear war.
Thank you so much, Mr. Billington, for being with us on our show. It was nice having you here. We've collected some social media coverages in this regard, and please stay with us.
Hua Chengying wrote on Twitter, "Since last year, the pandemic has affected the world in many respects. Yet despite the headwinds, Belt and Road Cooperation, BRI, has not paused, but forged ahead with new outcomes, strong resilience and great vitality." Stefan Horvath posted on his Twitter, "The initial focus of the Silk Road has been infrastructure investment, education, construction materials, railway and highway, automobile, real estate, power grid, and commodities." Piper Growth wrote on Twitter, 21st century Silk Road, China has emerged from exporting silk, porcelain, tea, and other products to high-end and new technologies such as AI, AIOT, fintech, and intelligent manufacturing. Laurie Lay Claire believes China's policies for trade, economics, and technology far outshine the floundering USA, and with this new Silk Road, China will no longer need the US for trade. Trump trumped us all.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Brain drain in India used to be an only small problem. But now, India's future is increasingly threatened by its severe case of wealth outflow, the emigration of the country's millionaires, or the so-called high-net-worth Indians. A large cut of India's GDP leaves the country every year. Considering the huge impact of this departure of human capital on the country's social and economic structure, the government may need to be faster on measures to reverse or at least reduce the figures.
It is a normal malady of the capitalist world that people accrue wealth in their home countries, then no longer feel fit for their society and move to another part of the globe, presumably for a better life. But wealthy Indians are on top of the list of those who leave their country through different investment programs. During the past 14 years, over 60,000 Indian millionaires have left the country, and in 2020 alone, more Indians than any country made inquiries for residence by investment or citizenship by investment programs. This shows a 63% rise compared with the figure of 2019. The 2020 Global Wealth Migration Review, issued in collaboration with the New World Wealth, found that in 2019, India had the second biggest wealth outflow after China. Investment-linked migration is not cheap, ranging from half to $1 million in average, but sometimes the price is more than money. Since India does not permit dual citizenship, opting for citizenship by investment means giving up the Indian passport. Almost all of these affluent Indians had already had lavish fantasy-like lifestyles. So what's wrong at home that can justify such a price? For any moves to address the issue, Indian authorities and policymakers may have to explore the thought process and reasons behind such a trade-off.
The richest Indians, who reportedly have been getting even richer despite the global chain of all the unfortunate events following the COVID-19 pandemic, are moving towards what is often called the developed nations. The top destinations for Indian millionaires are usually England, the US, Australia, the UAE, and Singapore. However, there are new favorites among Indians with deep pockets too.
Wealthy Indians aspire to migrate abroad over various reasons, from better employment opportunities to ease of doing business, from security concerns to better conditions of living and education. In addition to all-time favorite destinations, the top investment-linked residence and citizenship programs that Indians inquired about in 2020 were for residency for Canada, Portugal, Austria, Malta, and Turkey, as well as New Zealand, each for different reasons. Europe, for instance, is mentioned as the target of those who want to obtain better mobility, and North America for those who prioritize a better educational future for the next generation. However, each country has diverse good and bad points. For example, the US, Australia, and England have the same language with high standards of living, while countries like the UAE and Singapore have more convenient financial structures. With the surge in high net worth Indians leaving the country, capital is going out, talents are going out, entrepreneurial chances and prospects of a prosperous economy are going out. India needs effective plans and actions, perhaps up-to-date universities and regulations to ease business are a good start.
Now, to have more insight and analysis, we are joined by Mr. Uday Bhaskar, who is the Director of Society for Policy Studies. Mr. Bhaskar, welcome. So, why do Indian millionaires leave India? What are the factors behind the wealth outflow? And why did more than 5,000 millionaires leave India in the last year?
My reading is that this particular number that is being now mentioned, about 5,000 high net worth individuals, as they call it, that they are choosing to leave India, represents about 2 to 3% of the total number of the high net worth individuals in India. So I want to place this in context, that while the number may be 5,000, it is about 2% of the total number of millionaires in dollar terms in India, which, if I recall right, in a 2018 study, the total number of millionaires in India was 256,000. So that is just to give you two sets of figures. Now, one reason why high net worth individuals are moving abroad is to look for better prospects, particularly for their children, because now education has become a very high priority for any parent in any part of the world. And because of the pressure of numbers, India is a young country. There are a number of young people who are knocking on the doors of the major educational institutions, whether it is the universities or the IITs, which are globally recognized, or medical schools, engineering, and so on. And clearly, the available educational capacity is not able to accommodate the aspirations of young India. And those who can afford it are looking for educational opportunities outside of India. And they generally go to countries where English is the language that is spoken. So by and large, you'll find that many of these people who are choosing to go outside of India and giving up their Indian citizenship in some cases.
All right, Mr. Bhaskar, before moving ahead, I would like you to see the media coverages in this regard, which our team has collected, and then we can move ahead. Please stay with us.
In 2020, wealthy Indians again topped the list of those making inquiries for residence by investment or citizenship by investment programs. The number of inquiries rose from 2019, said a facilitating agency. As per Global Wealth Migration Review issued by New World Wealth, a wealth intelligence firm, Indians were the second largest contingent among the millionaire category to move overseas. Nearly 7,000 wealthy Indians, comprising 2% of the HNWIs, left the country during 2019. It appears that the interest is not waning. India stands third on the list for the number of immigrants behind China and Russia. In fact, despite the ongoing Brexit issues in the United Kingdom, the outflow in India was recorded more than that in the UK, while China recorded the maximum number of migrations amid the trade war with the US. Interestingly, a large part of the outflow preferred settling in the US, Canada, and Australia, thanks to the climatic conditions, better education, universities and schools, healthcare and tax system. Nevertheless, India's total wealth is set to grow at a handsome rate in the next 10 years. The GWMR notes that India will outperform the UK and Germany in terms of wealth generation to become the fourth largest wealth market in the world by 2028. Among the cities which will drive this growth in the next 10 years are Delhi, Bangalore, and Hyderabad. Delhi would do so on the back of its well-diversified economy and strength in a number of key sectors. Bangalore on its prowess in the fields of IT and R&D, and Hyderabad on the base of its being the pharmaceutical capital of India and its many special economic zones, the report said. Many Indian billionaires such as Lakshmi Niwas Mittal, UK, Mickey Jagtiani and Sunny Vaki, Dubai, M.A. Yusuf Ali and Shamshir Vayalil, Abu Dhabi, may have taken up residency abroad and turned non-resident Indian, but remained essentially Indian at heart. The list just grows, unarguably raising concerns for the government that is struggling to spread prosperity around and improve employment opportunities.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Bhaskar. So continuing now and moving forward, what are the impacts of the high rate of immigration among the Indian affluent society of the country's economy?
Well, definitely it's a kind of brain drain, because many of India's top educational institutions, particularly the IITs, that is the Indian Institute of Technology, the medical schools, the business schools, some of the engineering schools, the most, I would say, qualified, the top tier, would look abroad for better opportunities, because I think we must accept that they also get a much higher kind of, shall we say, material return, whether it is by way of salary or the way of life or long-term kind of prospects and so on, which again is a very natural kind of impulse. I think for India, this does pose, as I said, a certain challenge, because you train and educate these people within India, but yet they choose to make their lives abroad. But at the same time, you cannot prevent them, because I think that would not be correct either. So we have to find a way of attracting, retaining the Indian talent and giving them appropriate incentives. And I think the government is very, very aware of this, and they are trying to see how best to retain the Indian talent in India.
All right, that marks the end of this session. Thank you so much, Mr. Bhaskar, for being with us. We have collected some coverages of what has been going on cyberspace and social media in this regard. So please stay with us. Thank you.
Ninja Monkey believes, while many in India talk of brain drain, few are actually ready to pay top dollar for top talent. Fact is, if you really want to attract the best, you'll need to put your money where your mouth is. P. Surya Kumaran posted on his Twitter, high proportion of US and Great Britain robotic surgeons are Indian. We would have a reverse brain drain problem if they went back to India. Ashish Shah wrote on his Twitter, from brain drain to brain gain, India tech boom is bringing scientists and technologists back from the West to India. Meg Updates posted on his Twitter, Indian Americans are taking over the country US. Joe Biden referring to NASA's successful mission and high numbers in his administration. Saket Kumar Chondhari wrote on his Twitter, what is incredible in brain drain from India? Isn't this shameful that we aren't able to keep our talents with us? Sorry to say, but if you are the CEO of Gov's think tank, only God can save us.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for today. Today we covered the issues of the digital Silk Road and the emigration of Indian millionaires towards the Western countries. We'll meet next week.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.